welcome to this premiere episode of The Death Cast. I am best-selling author Ian Totten, and I will be your guide through the world of the macabre. The first case we're going to look at is the one that got me into true crime. It's the Schwartz family murders, which took place in January 1984, with the murders of Bob and Kay Schwartz in their home in Cape St. Clair, Maryland. The morning of January 17, 1984 was an exceptionally cold one. There had been a snowfall the previous evening, and as a result, it was the first official snow day of the year. Paramedics arrived to Schwartz's home shortly after 7 o'clock after receiving a 911 call from their middle child, Larry Schwartz, stating that he had seen his mother dead in the backyard. Upon reaching the home, the paramedics found the children, Larry, and his younger sister, Anne, huddled inside the front door, holding hands. Upon inspecting the scene, they found the father, 52-year-old Robert Bob Schwartz, in his basement office. He had been stabbed in the arms and chest. Blood was splattered across his body. Looking in the backyard, they saw the body of 43-year-old Catherine Ann K. Schwartz lying naked in the snow, a single sock stuck to one foot. Upon closer examination, it was found that K. had been nearly scalped, her head caved in by some unseen object. Deep lacerations were present around her throat. One of the EMS workers placed a blanket over her body before going to talk to the children. Larry stated he had been awoken by his sister, Anne, who had been unable to find their parents. He had walked through the house before finally looking out the kitchen window, where he saw his mother's lifeless body lying in the snow, at which point he called the police. When the detectives from the Arundel County Sheriff's Department arrived, they immediately secured the crime scene and took stock of the situation. The search of the home produced several clues. First, nothing of any value seemed to have been stolen. Secondly, a blood trail led outside, indicating that Kay's body had been dragged to where it was found. In addition, a bloody palm print was found on the glass of the patio door. They also uncovered a bloody wood-splitting maul out in a wet wooded area behind the house. Noticing the commotion, a neighbor flagged down the detectives and alerted them to blood that he saw in his front yard. Investigators followed that trail, along with a series of footprints from the neighbor's house through the neighborhood and into the woods behind the Schwartz's home. The footprints included human shoe prints, paw prints from what was likely a dog, one bare footprint, and one that may have been clad by someone wearing a single sock. It became apparent to the detectives that Kay Schwartz had survived her initial attack and managed to escape the house, but was then chased through the neighborhood by her assailant until she was caught and murdered. Returning to the home, the detectives turned their attention to the children. Larry told them the same story he had told the paramedics about looking out the window and seeing his mother lying in the snow, except this time he said he looked out the dining room window, not the kitchen. He was also quick to implicate his older brother Michael as a possible suspect. He told the detectives that Michael hated his parents for disowning him and sending him back to foster care. Larry pointed out that the family dogs knew Michael and probably would not have barked if he entered the house. He told them that Kay confided to him that she feared Michael and that Michael had once made a joke about stabbing their father in the back. The younger child, Annie, told detectives that she heard a voice around 11:30 p.m. the previous night that sounded like her father. He was calling for help. She then described a man that she saw in the backyard. His back was to her, but she could see that he was tall with dark, curly hair and that he was wearing jeans and a gray sweatshirt. She went on to describe a bloody shovel that he was carrying over his shoulder. When asked if the man was as tall as Larry, Annie answered that he was not. He was taller than Larry. Michael was taller than Larry. He was over 6 feet tall. Alright, so here we have the first suspect in the case, the Schwartz's oldest estranged son, Michael. Now, Michael had been thrown out of the house a few years previously after going out to a friend's house without their permission. But detectives weren't really sure about Michael yet. They had a crime scene that had not yet been fully gone over, as well as conflicting reports from one of the people present, namely Larry. I mentioned a moment ago that how Michael had been sent back to foster care, and that's because he wasn't the Schwartz's real child. In fact, none of the children were. Bob and Kay Schwartz, who had met in the late 1960s at the University of Maryland, had been unable to have children of their own and had adopted the three children. First, Lawrence Larry Schwartz when he was 6 years old in 1974, and then 2 years later, Michael David Schwartz, who was 6 months older than Larry.
Both boys had come from troubled paths, with Larry, who was suspected of being Native American, thought to have been the result of a union between a waitress from New Orleans and a pimp.
Michael, who had been in and out of foster homes since the time he was born, was seen as something of a problem child, as he was very strong-willed and rebellious. He spent 2 years on a probationary period with the Schwartz before they legally adopted him. The two boys had instantly gelled, quickly becoming best friends. Bob and Kay, with their higher educations, wanted them both to receive good educations, but their ambitions became a source of tension within the family. Michael was an obviously bright child and a quick learner, who was said to be a musical prodigy. The first few years he lived with the family, he excelled to the point that the Schwartzes decided he was not being challenged enough and had him skip from the second to fourth grades. This change had an adverse effect on Michael, who was an emotionally immature, aggressive child, as his grades began to slip and his disciplinary problems increased.
He was an impulsive, disobedient boy who often had fits of rage and did not seem to understand right from wrong.
On the flip side of that, his brother Larry was an awful student.
Bob and Kay became concerned with his inability to learn and had him tested. Larry was found to be learning disabled and placed into special needs classes
that apparently had a positive effect on his performance. He was also a quiet, mild-mannered, well-behaved child who followed the rules both at school and home. Many who knew the family said that he was obvious he was the favorite son, and I've read a few accounts where he's been described as a mama's boy.
The detectives didn't know any of this at the time, however. All they knew was that they had a double homicide and a young man who seemed overly helpful. While Annie was sent to stay with friends and family in Annapolis, Larry stayed behind, offering to help the detectives in any way he could. They quickly took note that he seemed determined to throw his brother, Michael, under the bus and pin the murders on him, something that they found suspicious. Some suspected that given the condition Kay's body had been found in, a sexual motive was behind the slayings, while others thought that it might be something deeper and more sinister, that the killer may have known and been intimate with the family, thus the level of brutality present in the killings. Maybe Bob had owed someone money, or they had possibly upset someone with their anti-abortion protests. The police just did not know. They felt certain, however, that Larry had something to do with or knew something about the murders. The first thing they had to do, however, was see if they could get a print off of the bloody handprint on the glass door and talk to Michael. They went to speak with Michael, who, according to himself and staff at the Crownsville Hospital, had been locked inside the dormitory during the night. One of the staff on duty confirmed that he'd seen Michael around 11:15 p.m. Based on the time Annie had said she'd seen the man in the yard, that would have given Michael only 15 minutes to get to the house and kill his parents before returning to the hospital. The detectives knew there was no way Michael could have done the crime and gotten back in time in order to be seen. Conversely, Larry had been overly cool, calm, and helpful that morning. Not at all what they would have expected from someone who had just lost both of his parents. He seemed to be completely disconnected from the violence around him, and was certain that his brother Michael had to have something to do with it. Larry had even pointed out to the detectives the batch of papers that had been lying out concerning Michael's legal problems. Would be some days before they got a break in the case, however. The bloody handprint on the sliding glass door came back with a positive match. It belonged to Larry. Larry was arrested and charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder, and his bail was set at $200,000. He refused to cooperate with the police or tell them anything, insisting Michael had to have been the culprit. That would change 3 days after his parents' funeral, however, when Larry confessed to his lawyers that he was the killer. He outlined to them what had led up to the murder, as well as what it was like to live underneath the roof of Bob and Kay Schwartz. The story he told was nearly as horrific as the murders themselves. Bob and Kay were an extremely religious couple, who often spent Saturdays picketing the local abortion clinic in Annapolis. Neighbors described Bob as the type of individual who, although nice, was very stern with his children, and would insist that they help him to help the neighbors in their chores. Kay, who was also known as a stern woman, would help the neighborhood children in their studies. Bob's temper wasn't just something that the neighbors noticed. Pretty much everyone who knew the Schwartz family said that they were very stern parents. This sternness did not stop out in public, however. The boys would often be punished for the most benign of infractions, with Michael receiving the worst of it. Often he would be ridiculed by his parents for his decisions or the people he hung out with. And as the boys grew into adolescence, the punishments became more severe. Bob and Kay liked to present themselves as, you know, a fun-loving couple who adored their children, but the reality is they were pieces of shit.
Larry was saved from a lot of this abuse because he was the favorite and he always strove to please his parents, and in fact seems to have attempted to defuse the situation a number of times. Michael was the exact opposite. He went to great lengths to antagonize both his mother and father, which led to violent outbursts on a near constant basis.
Bob seems to have been the type of person who believed in the old adage of spare the rod and spoil the child. However, in Bob Schwartz's case, the rod was his fists. Larry and Michael both said that they were routinely beaten by the man. I've read in a number of different reports on the case that Kay was not above beating them as well. It seems as though at some point, the Schwartzes made up their mind that they had to protect Larry from going down the path that Michael was going down, and they made a concerted effort to terrorize and torture the boy. Things seemed to reach a boiling point among the family when they adopted little Annie, who was 4 years old at the time. Now, Annie was a South Korean child who had been abandoned by her parents, and according to Larry, when she came into the picture, she pretty much usurped his position as the favorite child. From what I can gather, the abuse suffered by Michael and Larry grew in intensity shortly after Annie came into the house, and by the time the boys were in their middle teens, it was like living in hell. It all came to a head when Michael decided he wanted to hang out with his friends and Kay told him no. He snuck out of the house and went to hang out with his friends and came home later that night only to find the doors locked and no answer to his knocks. When somebody did finally answer, it was Kay. She opened the bedroom window long enough to inform him that he was no longer allowed inside the house and was no longer a part of the family. The next day, she reported Michael to his caseworker and said that he had run away. And when he was eventually found, he was given the choice of either going to juvenile detention or back into the foster care system. He chose the latter. This had a devastating effect on Larry, who, as I stated earlier, they were best friends. So now he's pretty much fighting this battle by himself, and he was trying even harder at this point to gain his parents' acceptance and love. Larry decided he needed to do something to get back into his parents' good graces, and it eventually dawned on him. The family was Catholic, and maybe, just maybe, if he were to devote himself to their religion by becoming a priest, Bob and Kay would stop treating him the way they had been and would love him again. And that's exactly what he told his parents he intended to do. In fact, Bob and Kay enrolled him at a seminary, and it seemed for a little while like things were back the way they used to be. But it wasn't to last long, as Larry's grades began to slip, and after a few semesters at the seminary, he was asked not to return. This, of course, led to the battles in the house resuming, and there's been numerous reports that Kay would scream things at him as they argued, such as, "You don't love me, you're not a good son, if you loved me, you would do better." All this stuff had a profound impact on Larry's already tortured psyche, and it was compounded by the fact that when he would displease them to the point that they felt a punishment beyond beating was necessary, they would ground him from doing anything beyond attending school, going to church, and participating in his sporting events. It's pretty hard to try and imagine what the hell this kid was going through living inside this house, where on the one hand, he's expected to live up to these principles his parents have set down, but on the other hand, no matter how hard he tries to live up to them, he's unable to. One of the key factors that has been pointed out that led to the tragedy that took place inside the Schwartz house was Larry wanted to get his driver's license, just like all of his buddies were doing, and Bob gave an ultimatum that if you can get straight C's, then yeah, you can take driver's ed courses. And Larry tried, was unable to. I think the first semester he got all C's and one D, and Bob refused to budge in any way, shape, or form. And the second semester he got a couple more D's, and by the end of the last semester of the year, he was getting straight D's. And this really inflamed the tensions and the fighting at the house. The one bit of solace he had was Michael. The two of them would talk at night on the phone for hours on end. Just doing what brothers do, friends do, bitching to each other about Bob and Kay. What Michael did not know, however, was that Larry had found someone who was able to get him a fairly steady supply of booze. So when he would have his nightly rose with his parents, afterwards he'd go up into his bedroom, call Michael up, and sit there and get drunk while he was on the phone with Bob. And Kay were really going after Larry at this point, openly mocking him for his learning disability, regardless of who was in the house, and basically just being pieces of shit to him. Not at all what you would expect from these supposed, you know, loving Christian parents, it seems the exact opposite of that. All of this fueled the feelings of isolation and anxiety that Larry was having, and the thoughts that began to dance through his head. And he was thinking about Michael, and it began to occur to him that if his parents could disown one of their children, what would stop them from disowning another one of their children? These thoughts in turn gave way to resentment and anger, and Larry began to become aggressive towards his parents in their interactions. Not as bad as Michael had been, but Bob and Kay both noted to family members that he was becoming combative in the arguments he would have with them. This all brings us to the night in question, January 16th, 1984. And this comes directly from Larry's confession to his lawyers. He had been going out with a girl at school who apparently Kay did not approve of. And upon getting home from school that day, she informed him that he would no longer be allowed to see the girl. As was normal in the Schwartz household, an argument ensued, after which Larry went up to his bedroom and began drinking. Sometime after that, he went back downstairs and passed his mother, who was watching television in the den. Kay asked Larry some questions about some tests he had taken at school, and he told her he thought he had flunked one but done okay on the others. According to Larry, Kay had been sarcastic and belittling in her responses, and this set something off in him. He picked up a nearby wood-splitting wall and began to smash Kay in the head with it. Now, there's no reports as to whether or not Kay was screaming or anything, but I have to imagine somebody's bashing you in the head with a sharp chunk of metal. You're gonna be hollering fit to raise the dead. But anyways, from what Larry said, he then went and got a kitchen knife and began to stab her multiple times in the neck. This fact was confirmed by luminol testing that the police had done at the house, where they found blood all over the stairs leading up to and into the kitchen. It was at this point that Bob came on the scene, trying to see what was going on. Larry began to stab his father in the chest and around the heart with the same knife. Once the two of them were dead, Larry busied himself trying to make it look like a crime had been committed by someone who had broken into the house, someone like Michael. In any event, Larry was not done with the evening's festivities. He went on to explain how he dragged Kay's body out through the patio door and across the snow in the backyard and laid her out near the swimming pool. He stripped her bare, and then in a final act to humiliate her, Larry moved his mother's body into an obscene pose. Then, wait for it, boys and girls, Larry began to fingerbang his mother's dead corpse in the backyard. The mother he had just murdered. Yes, you heard me right. He fingerbanged his mother's dead corpse. That's a final fuck you, mom moment, if ever there was one. Going back inside, he went to Annie's room. The little girl had apparently woken up during the commotion, and Larry was able to assure her it was a nightmare and told her to go back to sleep. He did not mention anything to his lawyer about chasing Kate through the neighborhood, and when asked about it, he said he had no recollection of it ever happening. So Larry ended up sitting in jail for 15 months awaiting trial on murder. Now, the day before Larry was scheduled to go on trial, prosecutors and his defense attorneys were able to reach a plea bargain. Judge Bruce Williams questioned Larry on the witness stand, verifying he understood that he was going to plead guilty to 2 counts of murder, which Larry promptly did. Judge Williams then announced his sentence. He referred to the murders as one of the most tragic events in the history of the county, while at the same time showing compassion when speaking of the trouble that went on inside the Schwartz home. He said that although Larry appeared normal, his court-ordered psychological testing showed that the teen was in great need of treatment. Larry Schwartz was then sentenced to 2 concurrent 20-year sentences, with Judge Williams suspending 12 years from each sentence. Which, if you're gonna be found guilty of 2 counts of murder, that's the sentence you want. Now, before we get into the final part of the Schwartz saga, I want to read a few excerpts from a Washington Post article I found while researching this story. I'm going to read them more for the fact that I found them fascinating, and I thought you guys might like it as well. The article is entitled "Double Slaying Strikes Exacting Parents" by Kay Thompson. February 23, 1984, all rights reserved, The Washington Post. When police booked Larry Schwartz on murder charges and the death of his parents last month, he emptied his pockets and handed an officer his rosary, a reminder of his parents, Robert and Kay Schwartz, and of the religion that dominated their lives. Their 17-year-old son they had hoped would be a priest was going to jail. It is a puzzling case, both to prosecutors and to the Schwartz's neighbors and their fellow parishioners at St. Mary's Catholic Church. The Schwartz's were a devout couple, many people who knew them say. They had adopted Larry and another boy about his age because they wanted to help children who had troubled childhoods. They ran marriage encounter sessions at the local church. Robert and Kay Schwartz were also strong-willed and exacting, several friends and neighbors say, leading police to believe that Larry was reacting to what one source said was years of extreme strictness and maybe emotional abuse. Larry made 10 visits to the emergency room at Anne Arundel General Hospital in the last 6 to 10 years, according to hospital records subpoenaed by the police. However, Anne Arundel County State's Attorney Warren Duckett said the records revealed injuries common to normal childhood skirmishes. Bob was very stern about morality and the way he thought things should be done, recalled family friend and fellow parishioner Richard Mayo. When anybody went against him, he reacted strongly. 2 months ago, Larry's sister found some pills in one of his pockets that his parents discovered were speed or amphetamines, Mayo said. Larry said he was passing them along to a friend from another friend, and his father warned him never to bring drugs into the house again, according to Mayo. Just from those few excerpts that I read, again, because I found them fascinating, I think if we read between the lines, we can see that the people who knew the Schwartzes had some idea of what was going on, because it's not normal for a kid to go to the hospital as many times as Larry did. And I really doubt his father, Bob, sternly warned him about ever bringing drugs into the house again. I just get this feeling that he probably beat the ever-living shit out of Larry over it, which seems to be in line with Bob's character and everything that has been written about him. Now we're going to go on to the last part of our story, and like so many other true crime tales, this one does not have a happy ending. Larry Schwartz was released from prison in 1993 after serving 9 years. A family who had read about his case adopted him as their son, and he lived with the new family for several years before leaving. He moved to Florida, married, and had a child. In December 2004, at the age of 38, Larry had a heart attack and died. Michael also had an unhappy ending. After the murders of his parents, he continued to get in trouble, and as he got older, his criminal behavior became worse. At the age of 25, he was given a life sentence without the possibility of parole for participating in robbing and murdering a man. All over a jar of coins. As for Annie Schwartz, there's very little information available about what happened to her after her parents' murder. All I could find, she was adopted by either friends of the family or family members who raised her. So that's it for the very first episode of the Deathcast. I want to apologize if the sound was off or my speaking patterns were wonky. This is the first time I've ever done a podcast, and I have to say, it's more difficult than I anticipated it would be. Talking into a computer to myself is much different than talking to another living person. And I'm hoping that as the episodes go by and I become more accustomed to it, the show itself becomes better. I want to give a plug today for the book Sudden Fury, A True Story of Adoption and Murder by Leslie Walker. That's the book that I read that turned me on to this case back when I was 18. It's a fascinating book. I believe it's out of print, but I know you can get used copies of it on Amazon fairly cheap. Again, my name is Ian Totten. I am a best-selling author. You can find the 5 books that I have written on Amazon under the name Ian Totten. That's T-O-T-T-E-N. You can connect with me on social media, on Twitter at Author Totten, on Instagram at Ian Totten Author. If you want to support the show, I am on Patreon. I don't have any tiers at the moment, but every little bit helps to upgrade equipment and make the show better for you. Thank you and have a good night.
Deathcast.